Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Om, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of Rabbi Adam Klickfeld's weekly Rashi study class.
Hello to anyone listening on the Temple Beth Om podcast. Before we start an announcement, I'll put this into the WhatsApp chat as well. And if you're not in the WhatsApp chat, let me know because that's how we're making announcements going forward. We will have class next week. The following 2 weeks, we will not have class. Several of us will be together. We'll be on the trip to the Balkans. But I and Leonard, who often organize the class, my absence will be away. So the dates are the last weekend in last Wednesday in March and the first Wednesday in April. So I'll put it in the WhatsApp chat, but I wanted to share it here as well. Okay. Where's my phone? They are nice cups, aren't they? As we announced last week when we finished the Rashi on verse 24, that's Rashi's last comment for four verses. He's quiet on 25, 26, 27, and that's the material we're at least going to start today and see how far we get. And on each of them, I have at least one other commentator, Booker Tocqueville, that I'll share with you, okay? On one of the verses that Rashi's quiet, I'm surprised, right? Just because of the basic approach that Rashi has to text, there's at least one phrase on one verse that I'm surprised Rashi doesn't say anything about, but Rashi doesn't answer to me. Okay, before we read verse 25, let's just remind ourselves what 24 was. This is the actual raining down of the hail, so we've had a very long introduction to that, and part of the length of the introduction to that is going to come back in one of the other commentaries we're going to read. But in verse 24, it starts to happen, or it started to happen actually in the previous verse. 24, Vayehi Varad, there was hail, the Eish mit lakachat betochar barad. We're not going to go all the way back into that, but something about fire that was taking itself up amidst the hail. Rashi calls this a miracle within a miracle, that it was not just an abundance of it, but fire and water were actually finding a way to come together in this plague. Kaved ma'od, very severe. Asher lo haya chamoho b'chol eretz Yisrael, such that there was never anything like this in the land of Egypt, me'az haita lagoy, since it had become a nation. Right? And we read Rashi on that. Any last thoughts on that before we go to verse 25? Barry, can we take the microphones off the stands?
Do we have any idea how many days this was going on? Was it one day or multiple days?
You mean the hail itself, or
yeah,
the whole?
Yeah, the hail. Yeah.
There's no internal clues.
That's a lead into my next question. In 26, only in the land of Goshen, how many days? Let's say the fastest horseback riding, would someone in Goshen have notified Pharaoh that there was no hail there?
Well, let's get to those verses.
Oh, we didn't get there yet.
No, we haven't read 20. We're on 25.
Oh,
so
sorry.
Yeah, but we'll get to that. I'm not sure of the. I'm not even sure if we know the precise geography of where Goshen was compared to where the center of Egypt was. Maybe
delta.
What delta?
The delta of the Nile.
Was Goshen?
Yeah. From where?
Hold on, folks. If you're in the room, you got to talk on the microphone. If you're in the
sorry.
Otherwise people on Zoom don't know what's going on.
Okay. Goshen traditionally is understood to be in the Delta. Typically, over the years, the capital of Egypt was down south, but that wasn't true at this time. The time of the likeliest time of if there was an exodus was in the 19th dynasty. For uniquely, the capital was in the Delta. It was at P. Ramesses and Ramesses. So it would have been in the Delta. It would not have been necessarily a long distance from Goshen.
Is it a one-day
horse drive? Possibly not even that.
Let's hold. Keep reading, and we'll see what we have when we get there. Okay, so verse 25. Rick, do you want to read verse 25?
Sure. Vayach habarad b'chol eretz Mitzrayim et kol asher basadeh me'adam v'ad behema ve'et kol esev ha'sadeh hikah habarad Ve'kol etz ha'sadeh shiber. Okay. Going off the Silverman translation here, Vayach barad, and the hail smote. You could say hit. Yach is hitting, right? Like Moses hit the rock and whatever. Throughout all the land of Egypt. Okay. There's a yativ on et for some reason to emphasize that little phrase. All that was in the field from man and beast. Both man and beast, it says here, but it says me Adam. That would be from one to the other, both. Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. And right. So here's the verb is after. So then the herbs of the field, Esav Hasadeh, Hika Habarad, was hit, or the hail hit, Hika. Different verb, isn't it? Same verb, different verb. Hika from Vayach.
Same verb.
Okay.
Because Vayach is a shortening because of Avalepuch, the word Vayake, and Yake would be the future of Hika.
Okay.
Hika is smote, masculine singular. Yake, he will smite. So it really should be Vayake, but there are certain forms in the Vav Haipuch where the last hey is eliminated. So it's Vayach, like instead of Vayivke, it will say Vayevk in Biblical Hebrew. So it's the same.
Right. And Ve'kol Etz HaSadeh, all the trees of the field. So they specify the herbs different from the trees, as if there were trees in Egypt. Anyway, Shiber, were broken, shattered.
Right. Okay. So a bunch of things going on here. First of all, there are three active verbs. There's vayach, there's hika, and there's shiber. So vayach and hika are the same roots, but they are operating in two different places in the sentence. And then shiber is a different root altogether. Interesting. Shiber, shin bet resh, means to break. But it's in the pl, not the pa'al, right? So lishbor means to break. Lishaber in modern Hebrew, we like to pulverize, to utterly break apart. So it's interesting that it's not just a breaking, but it's a more intense version of it. The reason why I point out the number of verbs is because it's hard to figure out which direct object phrase goes with which verb. So I think the easiest way to handle it is to put Habarad b'chol Eretz Mitzrayim as its own phrase, or in the beginning of the verse, or put b'chol eretz Mitzrayim in parentheses, because it's really vayak habarad et kol asher basadeh mi'adam b'had be'ma, that the hail smote all the things that were in the field, you know, whether human or beast, and then you add back in b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, where was this happening in all of Egypt, and then the v'et kol esav hasadeh, and also the flowering of the field, is not going backwards to the previous verb vayak, but actually it's the object of the verb that's coming up. V'et kol esav hasadeh hika habarad, and the hail also smote all the things, all the herbs in the field. V'et kol etz hasadeh shiber. So it's like you have verb, object, and in the middle of that object you have kind of a location. Then you have object, verb, and then you have object, verb. So it's a interesting choice of the ordering of these phrases. The first time you read that, one might get lost in the middle of it. Rick?
Can I also say Shiber reminds me of Moses breaking the, or dropping, whatever, the Ten Commandments, Shibarta.
Yeah.
Right?
Shnei luchot asher Shibarta, and that's also in the PL, the two, it's from the Torah reading for the fast day. So it's a reference to God, to Moses, not just breaking them, but as people have already said, shattering them.
Are those the only two places?
I don't have a concordance file in my brain, so I don't
well,
know.
Well, I'm asking because Leonard's there.
but we could figure that out. If someone had a concordance, we could figure it out. I don't know if it's only, I'd be surprised if there's the only two places that the root Shin Bet Reish appears in PL in the Tanakh, but I don't know for sure.
I don't know any other stories where things get smashed like that, but okay.
Laird Dan.
Thank you. I don't have the problem that Rick or others seem to have in terms
Wait,
of how
that they... was a little muffled, Larry. Say that again.
I don't
you
have
were
the
turning
problem.
Away.
That... You hear me now?
Yeah, you had been turning to your left, so we couldn't hear you. But now we do.
I don't have the problem in terms of parsing the sentence because the Anachta makes it very clear what's going on. To me, it seems to me that this verse is dividing life into three categories. Creatures, and then grasses, and things that grow on the ground, and trees. So, and I'm interested in the first half of it. And I like the phrase, see if I can do it without turning away. I like the phrase, me'adam va'ad behema, which I would translate as from man up until or through beasts. And I don't know if anyone's going to make a commentary on that, but my commentary would be that this was actually dealing with all the large animals. So it rules out and mammals, and it probably rules out birds and rules out insects, amphibians, and obviously fish. So it was only the large mammals that were actually harmed. Mm. What's in between man and beasts? I'm not exactly sure, but that's how I would interpret the first part.
Yeah. What do you think of the significance of the va'ad is there? Do you think that the va'ad is simply a the word to, like from man to beast, or whether man or beast, or do you think there's something more amplified, like not only Adam, but even all the way until Behemah?
Yes.
How do you hear it in your head?
Exactly. I hear it mathematically, like an up to and including.
Yeah.
So one of these, like a, you know, greater than or less than or equal to signs, those of you who are mathematically oriented, or an interval, which includes, it's a closed interval as opposed to an open interval. So it means from man and up to and including beasts. Now, however you interpret beasts. So maybe if you want to have a hierarchy or some sort of taxonomy of mammals, anything that is beyond beasts, which would be lower than beasts, because man would be the highest, weren't harmed, which
yeah.
would kind of make sense, because it would only be the very large animals you would expect that would be the ones that would be harmed by the hail.
Right, because there's more volume of that animal to be hit by a hail, right? Like an ant may not be hit by a hail. Is it interesting to you, and I'm asking this to anybody, that if we read it as... not only this, but that the taxonomy is inverted, right? It's me adam va'ad behema rather than me behema va'ad adam, right? It's like going down the taxonomical ladder, which I think is interesting, which is why I'm wondering if we're supposed to understand it as a not only this, but that, or just setting the boundaries, right? I'm wondering if any of the translations, I didn't check the translation of this one, read the va'ad anything more interestingly than from one to the other.
Silverman's got both man.
Go ahead.
Silverman's got both man and beast, so it doesn't
both
make it range at
beast.
All.
He okay.
sort of puts them on the same level.
Anyone else have an interesting translation they want to share? I'll pull up the translation on Sfaria. What's first round, 925? Is that right?
Okay. So I'll just tell you as quickly.
Everett Fox says from man to beast.
Go ahead.
And Alter has exactly the same.
Say that again, Larry.
Alter has exactly the same, from man to beast. And and Kaplan has every man and animal who was outdoors. And that was then obviously from the Kol Asher B'Sadeh.
Uh-huh. If you look at the screen, the sharing, Ilan, if you can get rid of that box, that would be great. The Koran, both man and beast. JPS, both human and beast. As Renee said, Everett Fox, from man to beast. Matsuda, both man and beast. Old JPS, both man and beast. Shraga, the Shraga, is that the one you read, Silverstein? Yeah, from man until beast. old JPS, both man and beast, kahana, both man and animal. So I think, so most of the translations are reading it plainly, like not reading it as hierarchical, but just setting out the edges. And of course, as is always the case, we could be, you know, reading more into this than we should. It might just mean the hail killed a lot of things, right? But it's interesting to focus on the choice of words. Marshall?
Yeah, I just have a question about the word behema itself. Does that normally mean beast? Because I'm thinking back to the Joseph story, behema gasa, and I think that referred to cattle.
Where's the behema gasa in the Joseph story?
About the years of famine and plenty, if I remember correctly.
Behema gasa is a rabbinic term for
Pharaoh's dream,
thicker skin and for tefillin. I'm not sure the word gasa appears there, but I'm trying to think of what you're referring to.
It's rach, it's rach and tov, I believe.
Rach and tov.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm mixing up my rabbinic and my biblical Hebrew sources.
When you're searching for tefillin, right, the store will be willing to sell you behema daka, right, tefillin from a thinner animal, but they'll try to sell you on behema gasa, leather from a bigger animal, which probably will last longer because it's thicker skin, but I think it's a rabbinic term. Okay, Stevie, yeah. And then we'll look at a commentary.
Just that the phrase appears in the 10th plague also, me'adam v'ad behema, but by contrast, in the 13th parak, where it's the weirdness with the peter rechem stuff, it has ba'adam u'va'ad behema.
Mm.
I have no theory to explain this, just these are the data points.
Yeah, this and this, opposed to from this all the way to that.
But certainly in, Makat Bechorot, it's me'adam v'ad behema.
Yeah, and there's two different ways of phrasing it. It might be, as we like to call it, a distinction without a difference. It's just two different ways to saying things, right? I'm sure in the last day of your life, each of us have said things one way that we could have said another way, and having chosen one versus the other, we did not mean something different by it, at least consciously, but we're reading this as if it's possible that every choice to say it this way versus that way could be an invitation for a deeper understanding. Okay, anything else on the verse itself or we look at the commentary I brought for this verse? Okay, let me share the screen. We're going to look at Ibn Ezra. Okay. On the word vayach, okay, everyone can see the screen? Sort of, it's far from here. Zot haita maka kasha. This was a very, very strong plague. Shaharag Adam Ubehema, it, and I'm going to interpolate a bit, it not only killed man and beast, Veshiber Eitz HaSadeh, and also pulverized the trees of the field. And if you think about it, right, that is pretty comprehensive destruction. Rak Shehashem Chamal Alehem, however, God had compassion on them. Now I'm going to pause it here, don't read the note below. Who's the them that Ibn Ezra might be referring to? He just said this is a terribly destructive plague. Rak Shehashem Chamal Alehem, but God had mercy on them. Who could the them be? There are two options.
Israelites.
It could be the Israelites.
The Egyptians.
And it could be the Egyptians, right? Why could it be the Israelites? Microphones. In what way, in our understanding of the plague system, could it be that God had mercy on the Israelites?
Well, if we just happen to read that the Israelites weren't affected by this, then it might be applying to them.
Right. So in verse 26, we're about to see that they were spared, and that's been the pattern throughout. And on what level could you make the argument that it was the Egyptians that Ibn Ezra is referring to, Shehashem Chamal Alehem? Where's Mary? We need 9 mics in this room.
I don't know which verse, but it said that some of the Egyptians, they took their animals and they took home.
Right, because God warned them.
They believed.
Right? If you look back at verse 19, V'atah shlach ha'ez et miknecha, right? God told Moses to tell Pharaoh, like, send word to anybody who's going to take me seriously. I'm giving you a chance to rescue yourself before the plague comes. So in Ibn Ezra's terse Hebrew, it's hard to know which one he means, because all he says is Shashem Chama Alehem, and there's no antecedent to the hem. So let's just play with those two possibilities. God had mercy on them. Bi'al miknehem, and on their cattle. Velo hiskir Moshe lefaro zeh, shera'a sheshalach paro, velo meit mi miknei Yisrael adachad, velo shat libo. And Moses did not kind of mention this part to Pharaoh in advance. Shera'a sheshalach paro, because he had seen that Pharaoh had indeed dispatched word, velo met mimiknei Yisrael, and not a single of the Israelite cattle had died, velo shat libo, and it didn't change his heart. What's going on here? He's speaking in very terse language. Look at the notes on the page. So on the first phrase, that God pitied them, I'll read it because it might be a little too small. The reference appears to be Israel, that God had mercy on Israel. God pitied Israel and their cattle, and none of them died, according to two commentaries on Ibn Ezra. Weiser, I don't know who Weiser is. It must be a 19th century, probably German commentary on Ibn Ezra, suggests that the reference is to Egypt. God pitied the Egyptians and warned them to gather in their cattle and stay indoors. However, the remainder of Ibn Ezra's comment does not seem to bear out Weiser's contention. So let's read it as if the shift in the commentary is that God had mercy on the Israelites and their cattle. Moses did not mention this to Pharaoh, this is the note, as he did in the case of the Moraine, the Dever, right? Look back at verse 4 on this chapter. When God is setting up through Moses the previous plague, Dever, right? Look at verse, so start in verse 3. Hine yad Adonai hoya, that's that really interesting present tense use of the verb to be, that the hand of the God is b'miknecha on your cattle, asher basadeh in the field, basusim b'chamorim in the horses and the donkeys, bagmalim and the dromedaries, babakar and cattle, ubatson and sheep, Dever kaved ma'od, a very terrible Dever, moraine, I'd never heard of that word before. Vehi fla Adonai ben miknei Yisrael ben miknei Mitzrayim. God tells Moshe to tell Pharaoh, the one that's coming up, by the way, I'm going to smite you and I'm going to spare my people. Not one of them is going to die. And Ibn Ezra is asking, why, if God told Pharaoh in advance that was going to happen on the previous plague, does that not happen in this plague? And Ibn Ezra's answer is, because he saw that Pharaoh sent agents and learned that there was not even one of the cattle of the Israelites dead, and yet he did not take this to heart. Look at verse 7 and verse chapter 9. At the end of plague 6, right, the pestilence, Vayishlach Paro, Pharaoh dispatched, Vihine lo meit mimiknei Yisrael, and behold, not one of the cattle of Israel died, Ad echad, not even one, Vayichbad leif paro, and he hardened his heart. We had a great conversation in that verse. That's an odd logic. Usually the Vayichbad leif paro is after he had time to, like, he originally had been softened because he saw how powerless he was, but then he hardened his heart afterwards. In this verse, he sees the very exemplification of God's power, that God was able to divide between the Israelites and the Egyptians, and in that exact moment, that's when he hardened his heart. That is saying something deeply troubling about Pharaoh. And according to Ibn Ezra, even though in this verse, we, the reader, are about to learn that God spared the Israelite cattle, even though God smote the Egyptian cattle, Pharaoh doesn't get a warning, because he got a warning the last time, and that very warning or that very distinction actually made him more committed to destruction, not less. Right? It's I hear in this, and I'd like to hear your interpretation. Listen, the text is as the text is. We only have what the text tells us, right? So the text is written in a certain way. But I hear Ibn Ezra doing his own medieval version of some of the equivocation we've been doing as we've been studying this for months, which is God really the good character in this story, right? And Ibn Ezra is using small clues to show that God has been planting opportunities for Pharaoh to do tshuva, to recognize that he's outmatched, to understand he's not going to win this. And Pharaoh has chosen to, you know, scorn those very opportunities. You reap what you sow, right? God has not just, is just not demolishing him for the sake of toying with him. He's trying to plant opportunities for Pharaoh to recognize the pattern. Pharaoh's not picking up on them. That's what I read into why Ibn Ezra is spending this time on this. Open to others' commentary. Larry and Diane.
Yeah, with all due respect, I think Ibn Ezra's got it completely wrong. God did warn Pharaoh.
Larry, hold on one second. Can we close those? There's some kind of machine going out in the field. It's making it hard to hear you. And speak maybe slightly louder.
Okay. So with all due respect to Ibn Ezra, I think he's got it wrong. God did warn in verse 19. In verse 19, every man in he's telling Moses to tell Pharaoh, every man and beast that will be in the field and that are not taken indoors. And then in verse 20, we learn that some of Pharaoh's servants who feared God, yeah, who feared Hashem, took their beasts indoors. So Pharaoh didn't even have to look toward Goshen. Mm. All he had to do was look around and see which of his people, yeah, brought the animals inside and they were spared.
Yeah, right. So Ibn Ezra, I'm not sure of the detail of the plague in the previous, but you know, by coincidence, you're not going to see the utter destruction where the Israelites are living, right? And that, and when Pharaoh is witness to that, it actually stiffens his heart immediately. This time, right, God is making it even more intimate, more possible. Like I'm actually allowing some of your people to become proto-Israelites for this plague, and you'll see what will happen to them, right? And it still doesn't work in terms of Pharaoh's change of heart. Yeah. Anyone else on the verse or on Ibn Ezra on the verse? Marshall.
Perhaps you just said it, but maybe I just didn't understand it. On that footnote 9 in the, Torat Chaim, do you have that in front of you? Or?
I didn't bring my Torat Chaim today.
Okay.
On the Torah, on Ibn Ezra?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's just show it to Rabbi Glickfeld.
Yeah. All right, footnote 9 on Ibn Ezra on verse 25.
Okay. So if he's here, O Tam, below Lolahimat Seba Sadeh, and then from Shmot Rabbah. And it says, Afilu Bishat Ka'aso, even at the time of his anger, Vayicham al Harishaim Vial Behem Tam, that he takes compassion upon the wicked and upon their cattle. And so I thought we just said that God was taking compassion upon the Jewish ones.
It's a machloket. On the people who have studied Ibn Ezra, some people believe that there's a full period in that part of his, almost like a paragraph break in that part of his commentary, and Hashem chamat lehem b'al miknehem, that yes, this was a terrible plague, but remember, reader, God had compassion even on them because God gave them warning, full stop, end of thought. And then the next phrase is beginning a different thought, or those two thoughts are combined, and the Chama Alehem is on the Israelites, explaining why even though God had compassion on the Israelites and God had told Pharaoh the previous plague that God was going to have compassion on the Israelites, he didn't do it here. So we can't interview Ibn Ezra to know what he meant, but it's vague. God had compassion on them. It could be two different thems.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sue. Let's pass it back down to...
I am getting a little bit lost, but I think the them is the Miknehem. Like, I think that we're in the Ibn Ezra, right?
Yeah,
and the them is undefined. I think it's the Miknehem who can't make any decision about where they're going to be or go.
Well, okay. Yes, and Chamal, Shehashem Chamal Alehem Ve'al Miknehem.
Oh.
Right? So God had passion on some them, and whoever the them are... They're Mikneh. Yeah. Okay. Anything else on that verse before we go to the next verse? And did I have another commentary on this one? No, I have two commentaries on the next verse. Yes, Leonard.
I'm just surprised that in Sepharia it has Steinsaltz. For the first time I've seen him listed as a commentator, but all that it shows for him is the translation, nothing, no commentary.
Steinsaltz as a commentator on this verse?
Yes.
I'm also surprised because he doesn't have a commentary in the Torah. Mm-hmm. Not a linear comment, as far as I know. Maybe he's it's like pulling from something he said on this verse that appears in the Talmud. Translation.
Steinsaltz is now in Sepharia, the entire Tanakh.
Wow.
In English and Hebrew, and the Rambam is only in Hebrew.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm seeing it too, and you're right. It's just giving his translation, but it appears under commentary, not in translation for some reason. If you want to know how Steinsaltz translated it, the hail struck in the entire land of Egypt, everything that was in the field, comma, from man to animal, comma, and the hail struck all the vegetation of the field. What's going on?
When you do that with your hand, Zoom gives you a little bubble. Do it again.
I'm looking at there, like I'm like, what is so darn funny about Adin Steinsaltz?
You're like it when you hit tight, you get a little
bit. Now I'm gonna have more fun with it.
If you do victory, you get like
really? Even if you don't ask for it?
Maybe not to block your face.
Yeah,
all right.
All right.
Rick raised his hand, so let's see what Rick's gonna say.
Hi. Just because we went backwards there, and you were wrapped up into the Mea Dam Ad Behema, the other two examples I could see in verse 19, it's Kol Ha'adam Veha Behema, and in 22, it's Al Ha'adam Ve'al Ha'behema. Mm. So I don't know if that helps you in what you were wondering about with
both
that.
Both of those instances are more obviously translated plainly without an exclamation point. It's the something Ve'ad that made me wonder, are we talking about some kind of a progression as opposed to just this and this? Yeah, it's the Ve'ad that invites that speculation. There's no way of knowing for sure. Great, thanks. Yes, Joel.
Going back to Larry's comment about, or somebody's comment about Behema, I mean, it may only be talking about the cattle or domesticated animals, but it doesn't mean that it didn't affect the everything else. It just means that it was emphasizing the stuff that actually hurt the Egyptians. Like it probably hurt the wild plants also, but they didn't care about that. They cared about their fields, their crops, and they cared about their fruit trees.
I really appreciate that comment, Joel. It goes back to what Larry said about the three categories of things that were smitten, and you're saying that these are the three categories of things that whose devastation would impact them the most, right?
Correct.
So you know, weeds probably were also killed, but that doesn't matter. It's the Esav HaSadeh, the cultivated plants, and the Eitz HaSadeh, the trees that were in their, like, you know, fruit fields. Great. So I'm trying to think, right? So smaller rodents that might have been killed by this doesn't matter to them because, I don't know, did Egyptians eat, did they have rodents in Egypt? Everyone has rodents. Okay, let's go to verse 26. And Barry?
On the trees, there's the vegetation was struck in every tree. I'm visualizing that the vegetation is low on the ground, but the trees are massive. And so this is hail so powerful that not only was the vegetation hit by it, but the trees were shattered.
Yeah,
and
good.
And the trees, like date palms, so they did have date palms.
Right. And listen, if you lean into it, it would take a lot of hail to shatter a tree, right? I'm noticing that at least in the version of Uncleus that I have in my Chumash, the pointing of Uncleus, which is a very, very, like, you know, you're going really down because, you know, you're sort of guessing a little bit as to what the vowels are in Uncleus Aramaic. The pointing of the Uncleus that I have points to Tavar, which is Uncleus's rendering of Shiber in Aramaic. A shin from Hebrew becomes a taf in Aramaic, right? He points it as if the verb is pa'al, the shva, t, var, not the Aramaic version of PL. So he turns Sheber into Shavar, which is slightly less intense. Not sure why he did that. I also don't know how they know that, because I'm trying to think of if the Aramaic version of the PL have a Yud. Maybe that's why, because he by writing it as Tavar, not Taf Yud Bet Resh, Unkelus is making it clear that he's turning it into a Pa'al verb. It's an interesting choice on Unkelus's part. Renee and then Alan.
Even though he only mentioned beast and not other kinds of animals, if he's destroying all the trees, then by virtue of that, wouldn't he have also destroyed birds that were in the trees?
Possibly. The birds are not mentioned. Why they're not mentioned is an interesting question, particularly if you think about what Joel said, because you would imagine that there was certainly fowl that was significant to them.
Right.
But they're not mentioned. Yeah.
Right.
Alan, and then Sue, or Sue and then Alan.
The Adam Ad Behema is not that it's not mentioned. That's not necessarily true. I mean, it's kind of like
everything in between.
It's like the Haggadah. All the days of the nights, all the days, including the nights. Doesn't mean the days and the nights, or just the nights, or just the days. It's like everything in between.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the way I would want to read the Va'ad, except that right. In the taxonomy, you're
alphabetically.
If I wanted to do an everything between, I'd say from the grasshopper to Adam, and everything in between is implied. But we're already at the top of that taxonomical chart, so that's why it's hard to figure out. Go ahead, more.
Well, yes and no, because the birds have an ability to fly away from all the destruction, so it's not necessarily that it's not included. I mean, our rules of taxonomy are not necessarily applicable.
Not technically, but I would assume that even in ancient Egypt and even in ancient Israel, they understood that if you're creating like a vast category of living things to include everything, the two that you mention are not mammals. You know, even if they didn't have the word for male, mammals and men or humanity, but from the smallest creepy crawly too, I would guess.
You have, in a sense, the taxonomy of creation, where it begins with
right.
The swimming things, the creeping things,
right.
The land, finally human beings. So you have a rough taxonomy there.
Correct. And a rough taxonomy, which is not that unscientific, actually, if you as you read Bereshit that way. Is that everyone? Rosemary? Alan?
Alan gave up. No, I gave up.
He gave up. Alan, believe in yourself.
All right, I'll share something. this be something, if you insist.
That reminds me.
All right, no, because it reminds me that you missed an opportunity to say your favorite word, or one of your
merism?
Favorite words. Exactly.
But it's not a merism. But right, yeah, yeah.
But you said if it's going from one end to the other, then
right.
It would be.
Right.
Merism, like soup to nuts, includes everything from beginning to end. That's the merism. So we're doing the same thing here.
Thank you. Right. And do you remember why it's my favorite? One of my favorite words?
It was at your wedding.
Yes,
God, you really listened to me. So sweet. So sweet. Yeah, Elliot used that word as if it's a common word in his talk to me and having the chuppah as he was just giving his drash. And it was such an interesting word that my father, who is the real wordsmith in the family, who knows, at least used to, knows every word, he had never heard that word before. So it's such an interesting thing that they were both speaking under a chuppah, and I think of my father as having the greatest vocabulary of anyone I knew, and my father-in-law used a word that my father didn't know.
And they also used it in the Ninoy's wedding. Joe, you take merism.
We should all spend 5 minutes living inside Joel Elkin's mind as he is preparing the next one-liner.
You know, your father's in good company. The Scrabble dictionary doesn't know the word either.
Merism?
Correct. It's not there.
Interesting. Wow. Maybe Elliot conjured it. Okay, Larry, Diane. And then we're going to go on.
So I just want to... Hold on,
can you hear me?
We can't hear. Go ahead, Larry. Diane.
Okay. So I want to relate to this business about Etzas HaDeh. Why didn't it just say et kol ha'etzim? Because it's obvious that all the etzim are in the Sadeh. So Etzas HaDeh is a relation, is a reference to man as well. And I'm not sure what to do with that, but ki adam hu Etzas HaDeh.
Right, in Parshat Kitetze or Kitavo, we're talking about Kitetze, talking about the rules of warfare, and you shouldn't cut down trees because it is a tree. It's a rhetorical question. Ki hadam etzas hadesh share whatever the phrase is. Like, is a tree like a person such that the tree could run away? And the answer is no. And since a tree is defenseless, that's why you shouldn't cut it down. So, but yes, I think the phrase Etzas HaDeh is intentional, and I really like Joel's interpretation before, that this is suggesting not just random trees that exist, but the ones that are in the Sadeh, the cultivated fields whose trees are more significant to the livelihood of the Egyptians. Yeah. But good reference from Kitetze. It's one of the, I know we're not talking about this right now, but since you mentioned it, it's an interesting phrasing in Kitetze, because you don't think of the Torah as asking rhetorical questions of like positing something. It's either telling a narrative or giving law, but it asks a question to which there's the assumed answer is in your mind, and it's one of the, it seems out of character in the language of the Torah, and that's why it's one of the reasons why it's so memorable. Okay. Next verse, we're going to read verse 26. Whom have we not heard from? Rebecca, you want to read verse 26?
Okay. Rak be'eretz Goshen, asher sham b'nei Yisrael, lo haya barad. Only in the land of Goshen, that there were the children of Israel, there was not hail.
Good. I'm sure Rick's about to point out that we have a second yativ in verse, two verses in a row. It's rock, be'eretz Goshen. So that rock is very high, appointing tension, just like we had in the previous verse. Eit kol asher basadeh. Okay. So we know what the basic sentence means. And we actually have been anticipating it based on Ibn Ezra's comment on the previous verse, that despite the fact this was utter destruction, plant, animal, tree, where the Egyptians were, in the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were, there was no hail whatsoever. Let's focus on the verse itself, content, questions, reactions, and then we'll look at a commentary or two. Alan, I see Barry.
A question: is Goshen a separate land from Egypt? Because if we're talking about, we refer to Yitziat Mitzrayim as our redemption from Egypt, and now we're differentiating between Egypt and Goshen. It's in terms of lands, unless Goshen is like a subsection of Egypt, or is it a separate? Is it a separate Eretz? Because it's specifically stated.
I turn to the story in the room. Tova?
I mean, we don't know for sure, but it's generally, in the things that I've read, Goshen is believed to be an area of Egypt that was in the delta area, the delta of the Nile. The delta was at the area where it was possible for pastoralists to graze animals because it was so heavily watered, whereas the southern part of Egypt, you didn't have grazing animals that much. There was more agriculture. And it was very typical for Semitic peoples to come in and pastoralists and graze in that area. So Goshen was that area in the delta. And what I was saying before is this, the period of Ramesses was unique because his family was a military family that was stationed originally in the delta and then became the pharaohs. And they kept the capital in the delta, which makes much more sense in the context of this story, because you couldn't imagine them every time this happened going from the delta all the way down to Thebes, you know, in the south to talk to Pharaoh and then back up again. But no, it was all Ramesses, which was his capital, Piatom or Pitom, as it is in the Bible, were both in the delta.
Okay. And But then
why the notion of Eretz?
Because it just means the land, the area of. We think of Eretz as a nation or a land, but here I think they're just using it as the territory of Goshen, the area of Goshen.
Is a place by that name or that sounds like that also present in ancient Egyptian texts? Or is that a uniquely biblical word?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. There is a lot of reference to Semitic pastoralists coming in and grazing their animals in the Delta. Hmm. That is talked about a lot. Whether they use the term Goshen, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I remember we talked about this at some length, again, it was a long time ago, in Parshat Vayichi, when the Torah starts describing what happened to Yosef and his brothers when they got there and what lands they were given and what they were permitted to do and what they were not permitted to do. I think the word Goshen appears there. I think we already have that. Yeah. And so it does set up this idea that when they came, they were accepted, but they were given certain agricultural tasks that were permitted to do, including ones that the Egyptians would not have wanted to do. And Goshen appears there.
Goshen is definitely mentioned there within Torah. Yeah. I mean, but it's always associated, it's the Delta, because that is the pastoralist. And that's what attracted the pastoralists from down to that area.
So Goshen not only appears in Parshat Vayechi, but also on Noah and Aden's birth certificates. Because the hospital in which they were born near Monroe was in Goshen, New York. And I'm sure you all are so happy to know that. I see Barry. I see a lot of hands, so we'll just go around. And I see on the
are they still considered U.S. citizens?
They are. They're citizens. They are. They can be president.
So Toby, you raise an interesting points here. After the number of years in the new pharaoh, and so we can't trust these people up in the Goshen area because and blah blah blah. So the multiple Semites, not just the Israelites, but multiple tribes pastured their flocks up there. So this would be sort of not a very secure area for Egypt. But now I'm picking up on Alan that if it says it, that the whole Eretz Mitzrayim, but not in Goshen. So it's kind of a that's difficult to comprehend. And my previous question to you, and you answered it, if Pharaoh's palace was so nearby, where the Israelites were in Goshen, and this hail, and it must have been very cloudy, gray skies with lightning and all this kind of stuff. And visually, you could see in the neighborhood over that it was clear.
You could or you could not see?
I would assume he could see this.
Uh-huh.
And so visually, it would be apparent. And now we have what happens next.
Yeah, right. In verse 26, we, the reader, are being told by the story that is telling the narrative that there was no hail in Goshen. We don't have that which we had in the previous plague where Pharaoh dispatched messengers and found out that was the case. We're being told it, but it's an interesting supposition that it was just obvious that if you look 20 miles in that direction, there's no clouds, right? We're 9 miles, yeah. Rebecca, was your hand up?
Yeah. Since the hail didn't strike where the children of Israel were, it seems that advice about taking your cattle inside really wasn't pointed for the Israelites to do that. It was for the believers in Egypt who would be in the affected area to do it.
Right. So I'm not going to make it fall here. But I am going to make it fall here. But even here, you have an option of choosing to believe me now. And if you don't, you're going to be demolished. Great. Marshall?
Yeah. I'm just remembering that, when we daven in the morning, we have the Shalosh Hashrei Midot of Rabbi Yishmael in terms of interpreting the biblical text. But I seem to remember in the back of my head that there's another way of interpreting that Kol Achin V'Rachin Ba'in L'Ma'et, that all... Whenever you have the word rock or ach, it comes to limit. I don't know where that's from. Okay.
There are several.
My thing is not working so well this morning in terms of memory,
right?
In terms of what the source was, but
there are several lists and also individual examples of hermeneutic principles by which the earliest Midrashic rabbis interpret the Torah. One list, Rabbi Yishmael's 13, is preserved in our davening, but it's not the only place. And sometimes, like the Talmud, will have a discussion about how words are used, and then say Zeh HaKlal. This is the rule, and that's one of the rules that achs and rachs come lima'et, to limit and restrict as opposed to expand the category. Before we hear the next one, I want to read, because you can't all see it, what Matt posted in the Zoom from Wikipedia. Sometimes it's right. The land of Goshen, Eretz Goshen, is named in the Hebrew Bible as the place in Egypt given to the Hebrews by the Pharaoh of Joseph back in, actually not Vayechi, I think it's Vayigash, chapter 45, verse 9 to 10. And the land from which they later left Egypt at the time of the Exodus, it is believed to have been located in the eastern Nile Delta, lower Egypt, lower meaning north, like the Bulgarians, this means yes, perhaps at or near Avaris, A-V-A-R-I-S, the seat of the power of the Hyksos kings. Yeah.
Who were Semites.
Who were Semites?
Yeah, the Hyksos kings were the...
the break between the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom, which is when the 18th and 19th dynasties were, was an intermediate period, and that was a period where there were either invasions or more likely in migrations of a large number of Semitic peoples who settled in the Delta area, in Avaris, in Tanis. Avaris was specifically quite a Semitic town. And that was regarded as a period when Upper and Lower Egypt were severed. It was a period of chaos and in the Egyptians' minds. Mm. And so, yes, that's when chariots and horses were introduced. The Hyksos brought those in.
Anyone else have their hand up on this verse? No? All right, so let me read. Should we do the commentary we can do? Rick, your hand was up. It's now down. Okay. Larry, Diane?
Yeah, I was just going to say Goshen was in Genesis. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
You had given Rick an opportunity, but he didn't take. So the Yativ on Rock, which doesn't appear on the Safaria version, at least in the iPad, for whatever reason. It's probably because the Yativ is on the right side of the word, and it's just formatting error. But anyways, I have a theory. Rick can tell me if I'm wrong, or you can tell me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure Yativ...
Larry, can you speak closer to the mic? For some reason, you're foggier today than usual.
It's mushy. Sorry. I'll check the microphone later on.
Yeah, but we want your voice, but the baby's face. I mean, can we engineer that? Nothing personal.
Yeah.
Okay. Rick, I think Yativ only appears on two-letter words.
Wait, say that again?
I think the trope, Yativ, only appears on two-letter words. So it very often appears with et, but also with other two-letter words only. That's my theory. And if it's true, why?
Stevie, the resident laner.
It goes up to three-letter words, but you're correct, like in principle, but the cutoff is three.
I think it's, is it only one syllable words? Are there any two syllable words that got a yativ? I think there are, but it have to be a word that is stressed on the first syllable.
I think there are some.
Yeah. Okay. Let me share one commentary on this. Let me pull it up. Okay. Remember our friend Casuto, Umberto Casuto, that we studied, I don't know, back in the when we dealt with the kiln of the Shechin. The word Yativ cannot have Yativ. Yeah. Okay, so the screen is shared. This is 19th century, I think he lived through the early 20th century, Italian scholar. We talked about him before, that he's in that hybrid category of Torah scholars, that he was a very from religious, you know, Parshan, and also the beginnings of a more scientific and textual critic understanding of the text. So it's and there most commentaries you read are either one or the other. He combines both. Okay, look what Kasuto says. Omnam hevi habarad. Look at the next word, by the way. Shoah al eretz Mitzrayim, that the hail brought a catastrophe. Remember, before the Shoah, the word Shoah was just a word that meant like a destruction by fire, right? Kasuto lives pre what we think of as the Shoah. He's using the word not with any historical significance other than just the meaning. That the hail brought a catastrophe on the land of Egypt. Shoah is, by the way, understood to be connected to fire, and I think he's using this word Shoah because it was fiery hail, right? Aval machoz echad, one plot, nishar shaket uvatuach, remained quiet and secure. Now, the next words are in bold because he's quoting from the verse, Rak be'eretz Goshen, asher sham b'nei Yisrael lo haya barad, that in the land of Goshen, where the Israelites were, there was no hail. Betoar makat habarad, betotzoteha, in the description of the plague of hail and its outcomes, totzoteha, Niskeret Chamesh Pamim Eretz Mitzrayim. Five different times, if you want to count, he was doing this correctly. Five different times, remember we had a long lead up to this plague? The word Eretz Mitzrayim was used. Upamachat ba hamila Artsa. And there was a sixth time where it wasn't Eretz Mitzrayim, but Artsa to the land, referring to the land of Egypt. Vihine b'pam hashvi'it, the seventh time in this description of this plague that we have a reference to land, ba'a zichra shel eretz Goshen. There's a reference to the land of Goshen. Hashketa, which is quiet, v'habetucha, which is protected. You may see where he's going with this. It's a lovely little Dvar Torah, nachon. Kedugmat yom hashvi'i, like the example of the seventh day, yom hamenucha, the day of rest. Haba achar sheshit yemei ha'avodah, that comes after 6 days of plague, right? Of work, avodah kasha, hard work, hamutelet al bnei adam, that is emplaced on the on human beings. He is really giving a lovely sermon, right? That if you want to just follow the words, you have a comparison between the brutal plagues that come down in this land versus this little Shangri-La that's protected, and that being compared to the brutality of work and the ancient world, right? Hopefully all of us, however hard we work at our works, we don't find our work to be hopefully brutal. Most days I don't feel that way. But in the ancient world, that was the definition of work. It was brutal, right? Certainly if you were working in manual labor, which was pretty much everything, as if you were being destroyed. And then at the end of that week, think of what he's saying, what God and Torah and the Jewish people invented. There was a Goshen for you to be aspiring to. At the end of the week, you get to move from this land where hail is falling you all the time, and you get to live in Eretz Goshen for a day, right? And he's seeing that, hinted at by the way Eretz is used. And I could have read the Torah 1,000 times and never come up with that. And I don't even think he thinks that's why the Torah did it, right? Kasuto is in the era where he's sort of more hyper aware of the stretchiness of the drashot he's making, but he's saying, isn't that lovely? That as we are talking about a people who is enslaved and has no rest, and as we're talking about God's power to defeat the enemy, let's also remember God's power to have invented for humanity the notion of every person deserves respite from the hail. I thought that was just a lovely Dvar Torah. We're at 9:31. I see Rick's hand up, and then let's just finish these thoughts. Just, Rick, Larry, Diane.
Just,
yeah, go ahead.
Just real quick, I just looked back a little bit. You have Bain with the Yativ on 9:4. So it's not the number. You can have two letters or three letters. Bain has three letters, obviously. Before that one, 8:23, you have Derech. Derech Shlosh Yamin.
Right, so two syllables. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
three right. Letters, two syllables, first syllable stressed.
Yes.
Zahaklal. Yes. Larry, Diane?
First of all, that was a wonderful drash. I was going to say, for me, this verse brings to mind Ufros Aleinu Shekat Shlomecha, which we read in Hashkivenu, and three times on Shabbat in Hashkivenu. And now we've incorporated it into our daily davening with the combined prayer that you've put together for the...
that to what?
But in contrast to Barry's vision of there being no clouds, there are clouds, but there is extended
Shalom.
Goshen protecting all of Goshen. That's just my own vision of how it's protected.
Got it. Great. Okay, next week we'll start with the next verse, and there's still more verses without Rashi. And remember, I'll put in the chat, we meet next week and then not for the 2 weeks after that. Have a good day, everyone.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.